pretty much every election cycle in America, someone running for office proposes new restrictions on people getting assistance from the government. We go through waves of welfare reform, making sure that people getting a hand from the government put in some effort themselves. For a long time now, receiving government assistance has been tied to seeking and holding work. And who does that usually affect? Women, especially women of color. That aspect of welfare reform is explored at length in a new book called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. It's the work of Felicia Kornbluh and Gwendolyn Mink. Felicia Kornbluh is an associate professor of history and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Vermont. Gwendolyn Mink is an independent scholar and author. Both have written previous works about welfare, and Felicia Kornbluh is our guest. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have been down this path before. How does this particular book differ in focus or investigation by either you or Gwendolyn?
Well, this book is the first book-length effort to study the origins of the major, major welfare reform that happened in the middle 1990s when Bill Clinton was president, and then to follow out its legacy over two decades, over the 20 years that followed. So we really go through the 2016 elections, and, you know, I'm trained as a historian. Mostly historians don't study things that are so recent, but I felt, and we together felt like this was an important chapter to really set the record on.
And you put a lot of yourself into this work. I mean, you and Gwendolyn worked to oppose what became that 96 welfare reform, didn't you?
Yes, we were both involved. So my co-author, Gwendolyn Mink, she's a political scientist, and her mother was a member of Congress for many years. Her mother was Representative Patsy Mink of Hawaii, who was the first woman of color ever to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives, starting in the 1970s. And we were all involved, Representative Mink and also Gwendolyn Mink and I were involved in the 1990s when President Clinton first was proposing what we considered a very dramatic and kind of anti-woman or anti-mother welfare reform proposal. And then later when the Republicans took both houses of Congress in 1994 and they wrote an even more dramatic or draconian, as we would see it, version of that welfare policy, we again kind of mobilized into action to oppose what the Republicans were up to and also to implore the Democratic president, President Clinton, to not sign that bill. And we had a feminist network around the country of writers and advocates and activists. It wasn't a lot of people, but it was people who had, you know, deep research interest and expertise on this issue. And, you know, we lobbied both houses of Congress and especially lobbied women members of Congress, and we got pretty far, and we lost. That's basically the story.
Right, and so here we are 22 years later looking at the effect of it all, and you do not sugarcoat it. You say 1996 welfare reform is national policy that promotes the death of mothers. How?
Well, we were using, in talking particularly about death rates, I mean, I know it's very grim, but we found some research that some public health scholars had done looking over almost this whole time period that we were interested in, and they could really see under the old policy regime that had ruled from the 1930s, the New Deal period, through the 1990s, you see certain kinds of predictable outcomes, and then after 1996, you see different outcomes. And I think there are at least two things that are going on. One is the particulars of the new law. The new law says that you can only receive aid for a maximum of 5 years over your whole lifetime. And many states have made that even much shorter than 5 years. And what that means is, you know, if you're raising young kids, let's say you have more than one kid, 5 years isn't really enough time to get more than one kid, you know, into full-time, full-day schooling, right? So there's a problem right there. And then people may have more than one, you know, period in time in their lives when things get bad and they need assistance. Like, I don't know, if you have an abusive boyfriend or husband or something like that and you need to get away, you know, that five-year time limit, I think, becomes problematic for a lot of people. So that's the actual rules of the law, I think, drive people off the rolls and expose them to all kinds of vulnerabilities that lead to bad health outcomes and even to their early death. And then there's the other side of it, which is just in general, this cash assistance program, this public assistance program for moms and kids has just become vanishingly small. And many people don't even know it exists anymore. People don't even think that they can get it. There's no understanding that when people, particularly mothers raising young children, get into a difficult situation, that the government is there for them and will support them. And so I think that has also led to greater stress and worse health outcomes and more economic vulnerability and even, yes, to people dying sooner than they otherwise would die.
So the safety net is smaller, and in addition to that, it sounds like fewer people know about it.
Yeah, that's right. I was just looking the other night. I was watching television, and there was an ad on TV about Medicare options, right? The different options you have if you want a prescription drug plan or something like that, and sort of reminding people that they had to sign up for that. And I was just thinking, wow, in this part of the government that I study, we never see anything like that. You know, there's never a public education campaign saying, hey, if you're this kind of a person and you're in this kind of situation and this kind of difficulty, you know, remember the government's out here waiting for you, and we have a program that can help you get over this bump in your life. Like, we never do that because it's so stigmatized, and the understanding is that it's such a failure. It's even a failure of the government. At least some people think this, that it's even a failure of the government if we're helping people.
Right, a strong sense of disapproval that comes from society. We'll pick up the discussion on the other side of a break. The book is called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. It's the work of Felicia Kornbluh and Gwendolyn Mink. Felicia is our guest on The Exchange today. You can join us by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to Felicia Kornbluh, who's a professor of history and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Vermont. She and Gwendolyn Mink, a political scientist, wrote a book called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we explore the effects of welfare reform in America and how it affects people negatively. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And so you're not the first people to get into the issue, Felicia, of that people have to do things they would not normally do just to be able to be eligible for the kind of welfare that exists today. So we've had stories in the past about women who had to spend hours on buses just to get to jobs they were required to get as part of welfare, which took them away from their children. So that raises the question, how did proponents of welfare reform square their avowed support of families with what the results of the law were?
That's a great question. I think uncomfortably, we have to realize that the Democrats in the 1990s misrepresented what they were doing. And the Republicans probably did too, but I think even more the Democrats, because they had a commitment to families, including working families. And they said, you know, the folks in the White House said that they were going to give everybody child care, for example, or at least they suggested that. And there never was a guarantee of child care that was provided in this law or in any other law. It's very uncertain for somebody who's going out into the labor market how they're going to find child care for their kids. And they suggested that they were going to find appropriate training and education and let people get decent jobs. And that was not true either. In fact, the welfare reform that was passed in the middle 90s made a huge cut in the amount of education that people could get before they had to take full-time work. So, I don't know, maybe the Democrats thought that they would have a second chance, that they could come back and amend the law and reform it and make it more generous and more friendly to families. You know, I kind of think that they did believe that, but they were naive, and they never really have come back and fixed it. So, yes, so they say family, 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 and women, 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 and we love you, and there's a gender gap, and women vote more for Democrats than for Republicans. But then you get into the nitty-gritty of policies like this, and you see, you know, that the support really isn't there for families, especially if they're struggling.
So what passed from the Congress in 1996 was called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Is that called PERWORA or something?
I call it welfare reform, or I call it PRWORA. Yeah.
All right. So it changed some things. Aid to families with dependent children became the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or everybody calls it TANF now. You cite something called the TANF Misery Index in the book. What does that measure, and how high is it?
Well, that's a measure that the NOW Legal Defense Fund, which is a really good advocacy organization, put together, and they were trying to measure the impact of this policy in one succinct number. So they settled on the a combination of the number of people who would have qualified for the benefit in the old days and the number who qualify today, and really the gap between their financial needs and what they were receiving from the government. And we don't have the most recent years, because they haven't been calculating it since 2012. But as of 2012, it was as high as it had ever been. And I'm not seeing it right in front of me, but it's a pretty high misery index, if you want to think about it that way. There are other advocacy groups that have studied, for example, the gap between the number of poor people in a given state and the people who are actually receiving public aid. And that's, you know, kind of a proxy for how much the public aid system is failing to alleviate poverty. And those numbers also are sky high, and as high right this minute as they have been at any time in the last 25 years.
I noticed, too, that I was looking at the poverty rate since the 1996 welfare reform, and it's been both way up and then down. And right now, it's honestly, after all this time, not far from where it was. I think it was the 13% poverty rate in 1996, and we're at like 12% now, so not very different.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Part of what's happened is that some people who are in the labor market have gotten access to help through the tax code. So it's sort of a different corner of the government. So the earned income credit helps people who file taxes as low-income earners, and that can be really significant. In fact, it's the earned income credit or earned income tax credit has increased in value since the 1990s, and that's made a big difference for a lot of people just in terms of lifting them up over the poverty line. In terms of their income, they're still working really, really hard, and there may be a huge amount of stress in their family lives, but in terms of income, those people are kind of holding their own. The people we are really concerned about are the folks who are not connected to the labor market or, for whatever reason, not filing for that earned income credit. Maybe they don't know about it. Maybe they don't, you know, have the assistance they need to file tax returns that would help them get that money. And those people have gotten much poorer. And some researchers even think that, you know, those folks are poor on a level that's, you know, comparable to people who are poor in some third world countries.
So one of the things that the 96 welfare reform included, and of course, you know, there's a whole range of gender and race things that get in here. And one of the things it included was some incentives for the, at least people talked about promoting marriage, that they wanted kids to grow up in families with two parents and the parents are married and all that stuff, and then promote fatherhood at the same time. Were there particular incentives within the Welfare Reform Act to lead to those things?
Yeah, there were. And they've been strengthened over time. The problem is that there aren't a lot of resources that go along with them. So, I mean, I think, first of all, that most people who are raising kids really would love to raise those kids in a family in which there's more than one parent, because people understand that that's good for kids and, you know, it's good to have a stable relationship. I think it's two things. One is that there are situations in which that's not possible. for a variety of reasons, and also that the government isn't really providing meaningful incentives or strong incentives. So there are situations in which, for example, a woman is a victim of violence, and she's partnered with somebody who really shouldn't be participating in raising that kid, or shouldn't really be in the home, and I start to worry when the government is effectively saying to that woman, you should stay with the guy no matter what, where the government is sort of blocking avenues for women to get out of those situations. And then the other thing is, even, when it's not that kind of a situation, let's say that there are two parents who really want to stay together and they want to build a strong foundation. We are not really helping them in any material way. There's a lot of rhetoric, and there has been more and more over time, rhetoric thrown at them. And there's a lot of talk about how fatherhood is so great. But the main impact of recent policy has been to try and hold low-income men responsible, financially responsible, for their partners and their kids. And a lot of those men have gotten into very difficult situations where they're held responsible for child support that they actually can't pay. And if they don't pay, then they're charged interest on the child support debt, if you want to think about it that way, that they've accumulated. And sometimes they even wind up going to jail. And they continue to be charged for the child support that they're not able to pay to their partners and their kids, for their partners and their kids, while they're in jail. It is a really, really crazy system, and it winds up being part of the other systems that we've been talking about in the last few years around criminal justice and around over-incarceration, and then the government winds up paying money for people to go to jail, and it doesn't do any good for the kids or the partners. There's something really messed up about that. Like, the rhetoric has increased, but the actual material, like positive incentives that would be there for people to build strong families are really not there.
Felicia Kornbluh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a historian at the University of Vermont. She and Gwendolyn Mink, who's a political scientist and the daughter of a former member of Congress, got together to write a book about welfare reform in 1996 and what it has changed. The idea of ending welfare as we know it was what was discussed at the time. Their book is called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 for your phone calls on the subject matter. Your emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Anne and Eugene. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. So I noticed in 1964, after the Civil Rights Act was passed by Johnson and the Democrats mostly, that the Republican Party went racist under Goldwater and has never turned back from that. So in your opinion, how much does this lack of support for moms and children relate to racism? Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
So that's a great question, and I think that's exactly right. It is rooted in racism. It's based on really old racist stereotypes about how African Americans don't work or don't work as much as white people. And by the way, I saw some evidence the other day, really good evidence, that it's black women who work harder than anybody else, any other subgroup in the adult working population. And yet the stereotype is exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that worries me is that in the last 20 or 30 years, Democrats also have kind of taken on some of these assumptions. So Democrats are defending civil rights and defending women's rights kind of out of one side of our mouths, and out of the other are saying, oh, we need to get fathers, low-income fathers and low-income mothers to behave differently. And that is kind of playing into those same stereotypes. So that's where I would try and make a change starting now.
Well, it was a year after the passage of the 96 welfare reform that David Zucchino went out and did the research to come up with a book called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. What did he find?
He found that it really was a myth that that women were not living high on the hog while receiving welfare benefits, that they were not lazy. He followed women who actually were clients of the welfare system and saw what their daily lives were like, you know, how long they had to wait when they were taking their kids to medical appointments and the only insurance they had was under Medicaid, for example, or when they were going in for an eligibility check under the welfare program, that they would have to sit in the office all day. You know, when he saw how they actually were struggling to manage their budgets, to do their shopping, to take care of their kids, and that every one of the myths that went into Ronald Reagan and other leaders' construction of this stereotype of the quote-unquote welfare queen really was just that. It was just a myth.
Well, and you write in the book, you and Gwendolyn, that poverty policy was always gendered in the country. I mean, are we always blaming women for families being poor and kids not getting enough to eat and all that?
Yeah, well, one thing I think about is that it's gendered in the sense that women have always been vulnerable to this kind of poverty. Like, you could go back, you could look at 17th century towns, you know, when we were still part of the British Empire, or the 18th century after the American Revolution, and you'll see that there are women who become poor because their husbands die or because their lovers run off or, you know, or they something else happens, and they have to turn to the town. They have to turn to their neighbors for economic support. And we also see that the towns try everything they can to not pay. And they try and, like, push women out of one town and send them to another town so that they could be dependent on their tax rolls, essentially. You know, so we see that, first of all, it's really predictable that women who are raising young children are going to have some economic challenges, and we should just account for that as a society. And secondly, that it's been kind of a political football for a long time, and, you know, maybe we can stop doing that at some point.
Well, we will see. Let's get a phone call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Felicia Kornbluh, the co-author of Ensuring Poverty.
Hey, thanks. My question is that, you know, the liberal and conservatives really view the whole situation of giving people or helping people. And I don't know which side you're on. It sounds like you're on the helping side. But, you know, the people out on the extreme on the left side probably believe in, you know, like socialism where everybody gets help. But, of course, Russia tried that and wrecked the country because it creates laziness. But on the other side, there's that issue of the conservatives, the extreme conservatives who might go, nobody gets help. It ruins initiative. So which side do you take on that?
Bye. Thanks for the call, John.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think that the research shows that if we provide the supports, that people take us up on it. So I don't think we need to push people, but I do think that we need to create some real avenues and off ramps, if you will, from public assistance to the regular labor market, right? And the research shows that if we do that, we can do it. We don't have to compel anybody. We can let it be voluntary. And then most people are going to go do it. And if we make education and training available, if we make childcare available, if we give people transportation assistance, if they're in a rural area, for example, and they need it, then people actually mostly do that. And they figure out a way to manage their family lives and their work lives. And if they don't, then usually there's a good reason, like their own disability, or they have kids with disabilities, or, you know, or they're living in an area where there really is not enough work or enough work at, you know, at a level that they're qualified for, you know. So I guess I come out in the middle that that there are incentives that are built into our system, our, you know, our private labor market system, and we can let those, you know, we can let those do their magic. We can let those do their work. And the government has a role to play in helping people get there and making sure that when people are not able to participate in that way, that, you know, that they're healthy and that they're able to raise their kids in some level of decency and dignity.
The idea that giving people money creates laziness or leads to a socialist system is interesting in the context of some of the stuff in the book, because Richard Nixon, for example, is one of the people who talked about something like what we now call universal basic income. What was he proposing?
Nixon was proposing what he called a family assistance plan, and it was very much like what people in Europe and in some parts of the U.S. are talking about in terms of a basic income guarantee. It was pretty low dollar value for that basic income. So really, it would have been helpful for people who were in the labor market, people who were working but at a low wage. It would have been really helpful as a supplement to low wages. Some of the moms who were in the welfare rights movement in the 1960s were concerned because they thought it wouldn't really help them, you know, raise their kids without also working full time. But it definitely would have been a start. And I think it really shows us how much our politics have changed, right? That was a Republican president who we usually think of as being pretty conservative. And nowadays, you know, even liberal Democrats are really hesitant to propose anything like that for fear of being called crazy socialists.
Right, exactly. So much more to talk about with Felicia Kornbluh. Her book with Gwendolyn Mink is called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. We'll come back and take more phone calls and emails and talk more to Felicia in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to Felicia Kornbluh, a political scientist at the University of Vermont. She's a historian. Gwendolyn Mink is the political scientist. And they got together and worked on a book. They have worked on welfare reform many times over the years in terms of trying to get good outcomes for women in America. Their book together is called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the exchange as we take apart the 1996 Welfare Reform Act that got out of Congress and was signed by President Bill Clinton, and its aftermath after 22 years. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And this is why we need historians like you, Felicia, because as you point out in the book, intellectuals and politicians always think they're doing something new in reforming welfare, and from your perspective, they're not.
Yeah. It's difficult for me as a historian because what historians are supposed to study is change over time. But if you study American social welfare, and especially if you have women kind of as your centerpiece, then you actually see a lot of repeats over and over again, same conversations. And I don't know, maybe at some point we can have a new conversation and we could think about how to sustain our families instead of trying to think about, I don't know, how to save a dollar here and save a dollar there.
As you point out, there have been many votes on welfare reform over the years. There was a reform vote in 1988, and President Reagan mentioned a Democrat who he was giving some credit to, the governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. So he was before welfare reform, before he was even president, and before he was more or less forced by an entirely Republican Congress to pass the law.
Yes, that's right. One of the puzzles in this story, and it's a historian's puzzle, but I think it's important to think about, is that, you know, there was a major welfare reform that happened in 1988, and it was Reagan, and it was some Democrats in Congress like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late senator from New York, and it seemed like that was a solution. It wasn't a perfect law, but the good part of it was that it really supported education and training for people who are receiving welfare. And it sort of said, you know, we're going to make you a deal. We're going to try and get people off the welfare rolls, but we're going to let people gain the education and training they need to get good jobs. And so I wonder, why did we need another welfare reform so soon after that, right? Only 8 years later, we have another major, major welfare reform, which has become the one that we're still dealing with today. And I think what that points to is that this is more of a political football than a real conversation about public policy. And it became, because of the race, because of the gender dimensions of it, it became so politically important, even though there wasn't actually a public policy need to make this change in the first place.
It's often, it seems like, especially when you look at the other people with get tough policies, including Governor Dukakis in Massachusetts, that this is a way to look like you're the tough but fair candidate, a way to get elected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, it was very much true in the 1980s and 1990s. It was totally at the center of politics, and it was Republicans saying, oh, you know, this is the perfect way to talk about how Democrats are soft in the head. And it was the Democrats saying in response, no, we're tough too. And I think now the actual word welfare isn't used so much, but you can see the Trump administration trying to bring it back because it has all these associations. And I think they're trying again to put Democrats on the defensive by bringing it back. And I think by remembering this history from the 80s and 90s, you know, maybe we'll have a little more skepticism and some more resources to understand how these kinds of ideas are mobilized in our politics.
Well, you're lighting up the phone lines here, Felicia. Let's take a call from Judy in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Ensuring Poverty, the author Felicia Kornbluh with Gwendolyn Mink. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My comment is that the idea that getting a check makes people lazy, it doesn't. Well, at least as far as I know, my husband died in Vietnam. I raised his three kids and our three kids with Social Security. That was an absolute guarantee. It came every month. And VA, widow's pension. So I had adequate money, and I used that money to get an education. I finished my master's degree and taught school. And I had plenty of money to raise my kids. But I think what makes people think that welfare queens, whatever, are lazy is that they're stuck with everything that I was stuck with, except I had enough money to pay for it. I didn't have anybody to take care of the repairs on the house. I didn't have anybody to take care of the yard, take the car in to get service. I had to do all that myself. And that meant that I couldn't do other things that, I mean, like be involved in community and stuff like that. So I actually think that's where people don't, they absolutely do not see the cost of, you know, living on a very minimal government check. And where they don't have enough money to hire any of those things done. I just feel like nobody calls me a welfare queen, and yet I've been on government support all the time. I got that until my kids were 18.
All right. Judy, thanks so much for sharing the story. I very much appreciate you giving us your perspective on that. Thoughts from you, Felicia?
Oh, I just think that's a great comment, and it's so revealing that, you know, we know from the evidence that that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't ruin people's work ethic or anything like that. So I think we need to remember stories like that.
Another call here from Kara in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Felicia Kornbluh.
Oh, good morning. What a great show. You know, I actually went to a welfare office in 95 looking for help. Fleeing, you know, it was a domestic abuse situation, and I was trying to go to graduate school, and boy, I remember I went one day to the office, and the attitude of the way they treated us and talked to us, I never went back, even because it made me feel like the word need, like I had a need, it felt like a dirty word. It like pathologized the fact that I was in a situation where I had a need and I was vulnerable, and you know, I just, you know, that was a big, big, big shock that I could be treated like that when I was in such a vulnerable position. And it reminded, just like 4 days ago, I saw this young homeless woman, and she was like 15 years old. She was almost like walking in circles. She didn't know where to go, you know, at 8 in the morning. And I leaned over out of my car window, and I said, "Do you need help?" And she instantly went, "Nope." You know, It's like we can't really help people turn their lives around if they can't actually accept that they're vulnerable.
All right, Kara, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Felicia, thoughts?
Well, I'll just say something about the domestic violence thing. I work with a lot of people who work in that system, and they're the ones who get it right away, right, that we need to have a really stable, non-stigmatizing easy to access system, because, right, there's so many other barriers for women to changing their lives, getting out of dangerous situations, that if the government raises one more barrier and drives people away, it's just unconscionable, I think. And I'm just really glad to hear, I'm sorry to hear the story, because I think it tells us what the system has been like. But it's really great evidence to have.
Well, you know, and I'm reminded as I hear this, too, about stories from my own family. My great-grandmother, great-grandma Riley, was 43 years old, I think, when her husband died and left her with three kids. This is even before Social Security, and she had to work her brains out as a janitor and that's what she got for rent. But you know, and so it often falls upon women, partly because men don't live as long as women do. And so you know, people don't realize that this is, in Judy's case, again, from Central Point, same story where, you know, her husband died young and left her. So this is why it often falls more heavily on women.
Yeah, that's right. In my grandmother's case, I think my grandfather was mentally ill, and they divorced at a time when people didn't usually divorce. And I think my grandmother was able to kind of do it, but that relied on the fact that her kids were able to go to public schools, including public colleges, and they never had, you know, an extra dime. They never had more than they needed at any time in their lives.
So let's talk about then where things might be going now, because there's a simple section heading in the book that makes, what you said earlier stark, the war on poor women wins. And so it sounds like there have been attempts to tweak the 96 Welfare Reform Act, but there have been really no major reforms since that time, right?
Yeah, there have been no major reforms. I think the Obama administration tried to liberalize a little bit at the margins, and they got immediately slapped back by the Republican Congress. And what they were trying to do, they were just trying to give the states waiver opportunity, which lets states, you know, engage in some experimentation under the program and to see what works and to make the policy work a little better. But they got incredibly slammed, and their initiatives were totally distorted in 2012 when Obama was running for re-election against Mitt Romney, and so they never really tried again. And there is a redefinition going on within the Democratic Party right now. Progressives and Democrats are really talking about what they want the future to look like. And I think this is one issue that would be really appropriate for them, for us to take on as an issue that we could really take a second look at. And we could think about what kind of government policy do we want that would really sustain our families and would really help people participate in work in a way that is meaningful, in a way that works, and also sustain their families, including their kids and their elderly relatives and their disabled friends and family members. You know, this is who we want to be as a society. And I think that those are questions that we really have not been engaging in the last generation or two, and maybe it's time.
You know, it's weird because we criticize the England of the Dickens years for how hard they were on poverty, but we still believe that people are poor because they deserve to be poor, don't we?
I think so. I think there's a lot of that in America. I'm involved in debates sometimes in my own state, in Vermont, which is such a progressive state, you know, relative to a lot of other places where the home of Bernie Sanders. And even here, if you say something to folks about, like, I don't know, about kids who need free lunch in school, right, very, very often there's a pushback that says, you know, why aren't the parents doing that for them? Well, you know, the parents have to do it themselves. And if the parents can't provide the lunch, then, you know, then they're going to become idle and it's going to ruin their moral fiber or something like that. And it's a very surprising reaction, but I think it goes really deep among Americans. It goes really deep.
And it seems like nobody's ever lost any votes by proposing to get tougher on welfare. For example, the recent efforts in recent years, I should say, to put drug tests in as a barrier for eligibility.
Yeah, all kinds of things were proposed as barriers to eligibility, and there was an idea that that people were behaving badly, and that we could use the possibility of getting public assistance as a way to change people's behavior. And I don't know. I think we could change people's behavior more if we provided drug treatment, for example. You know, if we provided real avenues out of some of the negative, what we see as negative behaviors. But I guess because receiving public assistance is seen as kind of immoral in itself, then it gets married up with all kinds of other ideas about people's negative behavior. And those initiatives have been mostly struck down by the courts, which I think is a good thing. But again, we could use a more fundamental reframing that's actually about a positive approach. You know, how do we use the government to support the families that we want to have and the society that we want to have, instead of how do we save a couple dollars here and a couple dollars there? I think, you know, to a large degree, we've just been asking the wrong questions, and so then we wind up with the wrong policy solutions.
Well, we certainly have a lot of attention focused on inequality in the country today, and the likes of Bernie Sanders have made that very clear. The question is how that translates into policy in the years to come. We have seen what has happened in the years behind us with the help of Felicia Kornbluh, historian at the University of Vermont, and Gwendolyn Mink, an independent scholar. They joined up on this book called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. Felicia, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.